Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 197 of the Free Cities Podcast. Hello, hello, hello. You'll have to excuse me this week. I'm going to be really, really quick. I'm off to Prospera in a couple of days, and I've got to line up almost three episodes so that they can all go out automatically while I'm at the Free Cities Conference and, of course, while I'm recording more interviews. Got some absolutely phenomenal ones lined up. I'll start dropping them when I get back, and let me tell you, you're not going to want to miss those. Right, straight into the episode. Today's episode, well, I recorded it at Liberpolco a couple of weeks ago over at the Liberland Arc Village in Appatin. And my guest is a gentleman by the name of Dominic Frisby. Dominic is, well, as far as I can tell, the only person alive who's both a serious financial writer and a working stand-up comedian. 20 years writing about gold for Money Week. He co-wrote and narrated Four Horsemen, the documentary about the 2008 crash. He wrote Life After the State and Bitcoin, the Future of Money and Daylight Robbery. That's a book all about tax. He writes a newsletter called The Flying Frisbee. And if you've spent any time on the internet lately, you've almost certainly heard one of his famous songs. It's very rude, so I won't say it here. Just look him up on YouTube and you'll see there'll be one video with millions and millions of views. Right, his new book is called The Secret History of Gold. And that's really what brought us together, because we were both speaking at Liberpolco. And just before this interview, I sat through his talk on gold. Now, I should declare something for those that don't know me. I'm a Bitcoiner and I came into finance through Bitcoin. So I arrived at hard money through the digital door rather than the metal one. So obviously I sat down here with a bit of skepticism on the whole gold play. And I'll be honest, it didn't go the way I thought. Not converted, but I am rethinking my whole stance on gold. Anyway, we start on new countries because I'd noticed something that morning that I couldn't leave alone about the number of new countries being formed recently. After that, of course, we get on to money, gold, Bitcoin, China, debasement, confiscation, and pretty much where it all ends up. One thing to mention, I had a video malfunction during this interview, unfortunately. For you guys here listening with audio, doesn't matter, you get the full interview. If you're watching on video, though, it starts about halfway through. A card corrupted, and I lost a big chunk of my footage. Never again, though. I've got a new camera, and I've got a new setup. I've even got a little monitor to watch what's going on. Anyway, talking of hard assets, I said I'd be brief. This episode is brought to you, as always, by our wonderful lead sponsors, Veritas Villages, who build off-grid, energy, self-sufficient communities for freedom-minded people in Latin America. Their latest is Veritas Village in Atenas, Costa Rica, designed, of course, as always, around privacy, energy independence, and community. And you can buy your property with Bitcoin. Have a look at veritasvillages.com/freecities. That's our link. Please mention us. And I've popped a video in these show notes of a little walk around their new Atenas place. It's Patrick Hibbert, the CEO, on horseback showing you what's available there. And the first plot has been offered up for sale. And as far as I know, there's only a few left. I think there were 45 plots going to begin with. I will be seeing Patrick in Prospera. I can give you a lowdown after that. Right. Don't forget, Free Cities Conference is very soon. It's literally in a few days' time. So if it's a last-minute thing you're thinking about, I highly advise it. Great list of speakers. This is the one to go to if you're into Free Cities, intentional communities, or whatever, the full spectrum of the market of living together. This is the place to be. Don't miss out on the first time it's ever being held in a free city too. That's Prospera, of course, and I would say this one's going to go down in history. And guess what? You can listen to me speak. I've got a 15-minute slot right at the very end, just before the closing ceremony. And I don't know. I've written something and it's a bit left field. So look out for that one. But hopefully I'll make you laugh. Anyway, back to the conversation. It's gold. It's Bitcoin. It's societal collapse. It's everything. Just sit back, relax, if you can, of course. I mean, you might be bothered about societal collapse, but anyway, relax and enjoy my conversation with Dominic Frisby. I'm interested to know, to start with, how you heard about Liberland and why you heard about Liberland as well, because it's not the kind of thing that everyone comes across. You don't come across it easily.
I'd heard about it a while ago. I mean, I don't know how long it's been going on for, but I feel like I heard about it 10 years ago, maybe a bit more recently than that. And then I saw the president do a talk at an Acapulco in 2019, which I was greatly entertained by, particularly the line, "We are building the greatest tax haven that the world has ever seen." And so that's, I guess, when I think at one point I might have signed up to be a citizen of Liberland and sent, given some money. You know, we all sort of dream about living off grid and you know, somehow beating the system, and Liberland seemed like a legit way to do it. I'm not entirely convinced now.
Well, sure. And I'd quite like to talk about that, because I agree that I think when people think about Liberland, they tend to stop at, yes, Liberland should exist. And they don't necessarily think about the stages afterwards, which is basically, when I think about it, probably quite chaotic because of the nature of what they want to do necessarily. I mean, what do you think about the idea that you can do that in this day and age? Funny enough, I'm doing a talk in an hour, and the first thing I'm going to talk about is new countries being formed. But it just came to my mind this morning. I put it in, you know, I Googled it. Turns out since 2011, no new countries have been formed. Before that, when you go back in periods of 10 years, you get, you know, the Balkans and all that. Then you get all the African new countries. And, you know, you get masses and masses of new countries. And it kind of grinds to a halt in 2010.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I'm saying it in a kind of neutral way. I don't really know either. We've just gone through, since the 1940s, which arguably we have because the war ended, that's when it kind of started, a massive upheaval on the planet. And now we've ended up settling down, and because like all the big states have collapsed, and maybe America's next. Anyway, maybe America breaks. I don't know.
Well, it won't. But I thought we were in a trend towards lots more smaller nations. I thought Brexit was a sort of symptom of that. There was a lot of talk of Catalan separatism and separation. Was it a year or two after Brexit? Three years, there was riots and things. And a friend of mine is a large landowner in the Shetland Islands. And he made a case. I think he demanded that if the Scottish National Party won the Scottish referendum, that the Shetland would then separate from Scotland.
Well, it's not that. It's a pretty good idea, really.
Well, yeah.
I mean, look at the rest of the UK.
Exactly.
Sark, the Channel Islands.
Well, you know, Sark's a sort of historical thing, but and I've always joked that I'm going to be the first president of the Independent Republic of Dumnomnia. Dumnomnia being Curno, which is Cornwall. But in Arthurian times, it was known as Dumnomnia. So I always joke about being that. But, you know, there is a sort of a little bit of a separatist movement in Cornwall. There always has been, a bit like, you know, Scotland and maybe a little bit Wales. But the, you know, I already know exactly, if I was in charge of Cornwall, the first thing I'd do is I'd invest a shit ton of money in Newquay Airport, and you just look at the flight lines and where Newquay is, and it could be the perfect, it could solve, you know, Heathrow's third runway problem, and it just could be the, you know, the sort of stopping off point. And it's great. It's right on the coast, Newquay, so you can sort of fly in and fly off, and it wouldn't necessarily destroy the rest of Cornwall with air pollution and noise pollution. And, you just make it a low-cost, free-trading thing, and you just let the market take care of the rest. It all seemed to make perfect sense. Of course, there's a few logistical things before you get to that point.
Westminster,
well,
being
yeah,
one of them,
and they wouldn't have it. And I gather the town of, I'm going to get this wrong because this is just stuff I've read cursorily on the internet, but there's a small village called Piddington in Oxfordshire, which has had an issue with, I think it's something like population of 600, and it's just had 1,200 illegal migrants dumped on it in the barracks up the road. And so it's holding a referendum about whether it wants to remain in the UK. And
really?
Yeah, well, again, this is like
the local council, you mean?
Do you know, somebody's talking about it on the internet.
Okay.
So, and I just happened to read it. And like, I read the headline, you know, I was doom scrolling. So there's no substance to what I say. But it shows that there is an instinct. And I remember back in the 90s, they declared the independent nation of Wanstonia, a load of green that was in Wanstead in East London. And there was a big argument about where they were building. I think it was the M11 extension, and there was a tree that they didn't want to get chopped down, and they took over some trees. And there was a guy, he was a quite famous...
Swampy,
yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And they declared the independent free nation of Wanstonia or something like that. I'm sure it was called Wanstonia. So there is this constant thing, you know, this urge to break away from, you know, you don't... I don't like the obligations that one has, particularly through the tax system. And, you know, everyone dreams of designing their own little utopia and creating their own little utopia and their own little nation run according to things. I remember after 2008, Iceland crowdsourced its constitution. Do you remember? And then I don't know whatever happened to it.
I don't,
because it was the Pirate Party won the election and all of that, and so it just felt like a huge period of change was coming. And then, as you say, it just died a death in 2011, bit like the gold bull market. And I wonder why. Something killed it dead. Maybe it was low interest rates and ZERP and all that.
What about? I don't know what happened around 2010, but it would have probably been something that would have earlier happened and sort of like built up to that point. I mean, the internet's the biggest thing that's happened around this period of time. That's a massive thing. I mean, you think about the printing press when that happened, 200 years of complete chaos. Like, so
the internet has changed the world beyond all recognition.
Yeah. Maybe people are now realizing, well, I don't know, maybe that clamps down on people as well. Maybe that ad does, you know, pacify people. I don't know. Could do. I mean, you know, like I was listening to your talk this morning, you didn't mention 1971, by the way.
I did, but
in the way that, I thought that was the big story, 71, you know.
Well, it is, but I mean, one likes to be original in one's talks and in one's angles. And for listeners who don't know what we're talking about, I did talk about gold this morning. And, you know, everyone talks about 1971, and I've got a chapter about 1971 in the book, and it was a pivotal year. But hopefully I say things about 1971 that other people haven't said and make observations about it. But there was a big chart that showed inflation from 1695, and then you just see it suddenly go vertical in 1971. And I said that was the point.
Do you know why? I look on that chart, it seemed to do a bit of a pump around the 40s or 50s as well. It did look like there was already
the first
a move.
Pump was 14.
Oh, was it?
1914.
Oh, right. The wars again, was it?
Well, France, Germany, both came off the gold standard. Britain, it didn't come off the gold standard, but it did.
Oh, really? So, all right, okay. And that, I mean, presumably that will retrace. I don't know. Have you thought about where you think this is all going?
I mean, continued debasement of the currency, inevitable. It's built into the way that money is designed. It's not even designed, it's just sort of evolved. The money's going to, you know, the pound has lost 40% since 2020, accelerated because of, you know, after quantitative easing, all the money they printed went into financial assets. And so you saw bond yield, you know, the bonds go up in price, and the housing market and all the financial assets, houses are financial assets effectively, all go up in price. 2020, they gave the money directly to the people. And so you just sort of had runaway consumer price inflation. But one way or another, if you measure money, the pound's lost 40% since 2020. you know, but you're losing 7% a year to money supply growth. That's the global average. And, you know, inflation is whatever they said is 3-5%, but it's money supply growth is much higher. And that's, it's just built in and we're inevitable. It just, in 10 years time, the pound will buy a lot less than it does now.
And does that, I mean, obviously that doesn't end well. I mean, we know all fiat currencies do end in hyperinflation.
Well, not, I mean, you know, what is, that's the narrative. What is hyperinflation? You know, whatever the definition is, differs from people to people, person to person. But what you have to realise about is with physical notes, governments control the printing press. Okay, it's the government that prints the physical notes or the printing company under instructions from the government. So when Weimar hyperinflation happened, the governments had to have got the printing presses ready to print those notes. And they did the same, you know, the Zimbabwe government printed trillion-dollar notes. So, you know, they were complicit in it. And of course, it was their monetary policy that resulted in it. But and now, you know, we won't have printed notes because we don't use printed money anymore. But the I don't necessarily think you need, you know, a hyperinflationary event where everything suddenly collapses and that's the end, and you have a big clean up and start again. That's the sort of, that's the, you know, we think in stories, and if you're telling the story, that's how it would be, because you'd have the event and then the cleanup afterwards. And that's the way the human mind works. And the human mind works, doesn't work in this sort of continued, endless, relentless debasement. But that's actually how the world works, how the world evolves. It's, you know, cumulative and gradual and incremental, and all those forces at work. And then, you know, if you know, you look at water erosion, it's like that. It's just gradual, and gradually the rock wears away. And then if you might get a storm one day and a big chunk of cliff falls off or something, but it's gradual. And I just think it's the same going to be with money. But there'll be periods such as COVID where it accelerates, and there'll be other periods where it decelerates. So don't necessarily buy the collapse, hyperinflationary collapse story. I just see continued debasement, relentless debasement, and you know, continued inflation.
Not even for sterling, for the pound.
It's possible.
I mean, for the,
I'm
US
not saying it's impossible. I'd say 20%, 25%
right.
Chance. I'm not saying it's, but a lot of people talk as though it's inevitable, and it's not inevitable. And the probability that, you know, maybe I'm suffering from recency bias, but sterling's been being depreciated since 1914. And sterling, the currency, has been around since King Offa in the 9th century. And so, you know, the sterling is the oldest currency in the world, and it'll just continue to be debased. You know, once upon a time, a pound was a pound of sterling silver.
I thought the meme goes that every fiat currency has always debased.
That's what people say in podcasts. I don't necessarily think it's true.
Okay. Oh, that's good to hear. I mean, I've never heard anyone say that isn't true, actually.
Well, everyone goes, give me an example of a fiat currency that hasn't collapsed.
Oh, exactly.
Well, but there haven't been, you know, fiat currency is a modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
So, you know, has the dollar collapsed? You know, it has if you look at a chart from 1971 and compare it to now, but we're still using the dollar.
So you're saying essentially that it will just keep doing it?
I'm saying, in my opinion, that is the higher probability.
Right. So we'll just have trillion pound notes eventually or whatever. In a hyperinflationary way.
Maybe not in our lifetime either.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to hear.
And we won't have notes because we use digital money.
So what do you think then about the future of the monetary systems that we have now? Like, once again, I'll probably refer to podcasters here, but the meme is that, other than the fact that we enter a hyperinflationary moment, we have a reset of some description, like it used to be world wars. Maybe it's the, I don't know, the oil crisis now. I don't know.
Well, again, I think this reset mentality is born of the way human beings think in terms of stories. you know, you get your reset at the story, you get the wheel is turned full circle and you get your speech by the thing and then the world ends and you start again. But it's not how it is. It's just continued and gradual. And so I don't necessarily think there is this great reset.
You were in your talk right at the end, you were alluding to the fact that you think gold's going to play a big part in the future.
Well, it already does. It's already the second largest asset held by central banks. It's not official money, but central banks still hold it. I don't think its role will be as medium of exchange, except in extremis. But as store of value, it has a huge role. And I think as governments continue to debase their money, that role can only increase.
So, like, I was the first time I'd ever heard the story about China having potentially 30 to 40,000 tons of gold.
There are 30 to 40,000 tons of gold in China, for sure.
And how do you say
the question is, well, because of the amount it's mined and the amount it's imported and the amount that was already there in the year 2000. And between the three, that gives you a figure of 30 to 40,000 tons, probably 35, something like that. And the big question is, how much is owned by the state? And some of the analysts say 50 to 60%. And some of the analysts are a bit lower, 20 to 30. But the People's Bank of China says it has 2,300 tons, but there are other government departments that own gold, the military, the Sovereign Wealth Fund, and other government departments. But if you just look at gold demand last year, I think about a quarter was central banks. And so if you just assume that a quarter of Chinese gold has gone to the central bank, then you're looking at a figure of 8,000 to 10,000 tons. But I think it's, which would be more than America, which is the significant thing. And China says it has 2,000, so it's, you know, at least four times. But, you know, there's one good analyst, Koos Jansen, says it's China has 5,000 to 6,000 tons. And then Alistair MacLeod, another well-respected gold analyst, is puts it closer to 20,000 tons. It could be any number, but for sure it's not 2,000 that it says it does. China has significantly more gold than it says it does. And it's just doing the Chinese thing of doesn't want to rock the boat, just getting its head down and selling as much shit as it can.
That was the bit I didn't really grok when you were speaking, is why they didn't just admit they had that much.
Because they haven't finished buying.
Right.
Because if China turns around and goes, oh, actually, we've got 10,000 tons of gold or 20,000 tons of gold, the gold price goes to the moon. And China hasn't finished buying. And the dollar goes significantly lower. China has $3 trillion, doesn't want to devalue those. And, you know, the financial repercussions of China coming out and saying it's got 5 or 10 times more gold than it says it does, it just creates so much volatility and instability, and goodness knows what it would do to the financial markets. And China's, we must not shine too brightly. It doesn't need to do it. If it ever gets into a conflict with America and it starts weaponizing its US dollars, and, you know, people weaponize money in war, then China will do that. But for the moment, it doesn't need to. Why would it?
Just explain that, weaponizing money in war. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, okay, so for example, when Putin invaded Ukraine, America froze Putin's US dollar assets. When Britain was at war with Germany, Germany printed a shed load of counterfeit British money and dispersed them around Europe to devalue sterling. When the American revolutionaries rose up against Britain, Britten printed a shed load of continental money and devalued the currency. You attack the currency because if your money's worthless, you can't fund the war.
How does that manifest in the 21st century then, when it's all digital? What's the methodology?
Well, this is the problem. America has total control of everything. It's got SWIFT. And you could just freeze freeze the assets of your opponent. You know, America could freeze $3 trillion US dollars of China assets if it wanted. $3 trillion, that's more than UK GDP and annual GDP. So it just makes that asset worthless. And it controls the global economy, albeit moderately benevolently compared to how other countries would do it, through SWIFT, through the banking system. And this is one of the reasons why we've seen such huge buying of gold since 2022, say, because US froze Russian dollar assets, and everyone's looked at that and gone, we need to own some kind of asset that somebody else can't freeze if they want to. It's all the countries along the Silk Road, and they're not necessarily enemies of America, but they're not great friends of America either. And you've got the choice between two assets. One is you have the power when you own the asset, and the other, you're in the power of someone else. Well, you're going to choose the asset where you have the power, which is gold.
And along the same lines, is selling US bonds also a strategy, for example, or selling US, you know, yeah, but like the stuff that of the US's that you own?
Yeah, well, for a considerable period of time, the Federal Reserve has been the biggest buyer of US bonds, and it's been buying it with printed money. China has pretty much halved its holdings of US bonds in the last 10 years or so, since 2014 was the high. And it's not selling it down. It's just every month, it's just slightly less, slightly less, slightly less. And it doesn't want to be a holder of US debt. And other countries are doing the same. And one of the problems that America has is who's going to buy its debt.
Well, apart from itself.
Well, it buys it itself. Companies like Tether, you know, it's going to have a big role in stable coins. And I think Bessent's hoping stable coins will be the big saviour. We've seen signs of that, but we've not seen proper evidence that that will be the case. But yeah, other nations, China, I mean, Britain still buys US debt because we're retarded. Japan still buys it, but the purchasing power of the yen's falling. And, you know, that's another mess waiting to happen. And but China does not buy, it's a net seller.
Is there any future in which you see that a new reserve currency of the world exists that isn't gold?
Well, I think Bitcoin is going to have a role to play. But Bitcoin's very good for international transactions, cross-border transactions. Obviously there's some countries that go against that, El Salvador and so on, but I think it's a while before central banks start holding Bitcoin in the way that they hold gold. And I think part of central banks holding gold, you know, Ben Bernanke said they hold it out of tradition, and I think part of their holding gold is that, or was that maybe 10 years ago, they just held it because they had it and they didn't feel the need to sell it. But for sure, gold is becoming a strategic asset. And, you know, it might be that we're living under the next Ming Empire in 10 years' time, and China rules the waves as it once did, and we're all using renminbi or yuan or whatever. But there has never been... For the yuan to become the global reserve currency, free floating, which it isn't now, and I think it would have to be interchangeable with gold. I don't necessarily think China will do that, but I do think ultimately, if it wants to be the major economic might in the world and the major military might in the world, then it would have to have the currency, the international reserve currency, but it would have to be freely tradable, and we'd have to be able to use it across borders, which is not currently the case. So at the moment, I mean, given China's ambition and its economic might and its military might, you'd have to say that, you know, there's a good chance, I don't know, 20-30% chance that in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, the renminbi replaces the dollar. But as a reserve asset, I'm not sure. And, you know, China's got demographic issues with its one child policy and all of that. And, you know, we see the rise of India. You know, who knows? The rupee may be the reserve currency, but I think it's more likely to be a neutral currency, which would be gold or Bitcoin. And gold's got history on its side.
I've heard on podcasts,
yeah,
that being the reserve currency is great, but it's also not. And America's a good example.
Yeah.
It's hollowed out the whole of America's industry, basically, because they get to open source.
Yeah.
They get to sort of put it outside the country. And that's actually what they required of being reserve currency. You have to get buyers of your currency. Would China think like that or not? Or is that a long-term problem?
Well, they're clever enough. And I mean, Vance was talking about that this week. It's the thing called Triffin's Dilemma, and he compared it to it's like having a resource curse. You know, the resource, if you've got the oil, it actually proves to be a curse, because you don't have to work for your money. You can just sell oil, and that ends up being a curse, and you end up like Venezuela or something. But the fact is, America can just issue dollars, whereas other countries have to work for them. And so America doesn't need industry. And the hollowing out of American industry has been a consequence of it being an unbacked reserve currency. If it had to have the gold to back the currency, as it did prior to 1971, at least in theory, then it wouldn't be able to just issue dollars unless it had acquired gold, for which it would have to, you know, it would have to mine it, the gold, or it would have to sell something to buy the gold with. But yeah, so so that narrative is taking hold that it's not such a good thing, and J.D. Vance has been one of the major proponents of that narrative. But yeah, he's the vice president. He might not be the president.
It's funny, along the same lines, your Midas touch story in the talk, not exactly the same, because I think what that was alluding to was that scarcity is good. I mean, the lesson of the Midas touch is scarcity is good.
Yes.
But still, it seems like, wow, if I can just get this continuously, everything's going to be great. In this case of being the reserve currency of the world, I suppose it's a bit
like that. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. And the ability to turn everything into gold turned out to be a curse.
Yes.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
No, you had some great stories in there. Like, what was the one with the river?
The river pact, that was the Midas touch.
Right.
And so
do you know what the
Midas's
other
power passed into the sands of the river Pactolos, and the sands of the river Pactolos provided the gold and silver from which the world's first coins were minted.
And there was something to do with Helen of Troy as well.
Well, that was a different story.
Oh, was it?
It was an argument about gold that precipitated the Trojan War.
Right.
About gold and apple.
I just wondered whether the word Troy had anything to do with anything. Does it or not?
Troy ounces, I guess so. I don't know.
No, I don't.
I guess all those, a lot of those traditional measures have, you know, the carrot goes all the way back to Croesus and Aliates, who minted the first coins. But I mean, the carrot was just a seed, and they used seeds for minor weight to use, because seeds were very consistent in weight. Barley corns, wheat, and carrot seeds from the carob tree. And they're just remarkably consistent. So you would use seeds to, you know, piles of seeds or individual seeds to measure weight and short distance as well. And so, so a foot size, for example, is a barley corn. I bet you didn't know that.
What, as in a foot? No, a foot.
As in size 8 feet, size 9 feet, yeah. Size 10 feet. Each it rises in, each increment is a barley corn.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But in the case of, so carrots were used to weight gold, and that's an ancient Greek measurement.
That was my takeaway from your talk, because I'm a Bitcoiner through and through, and when I think about gold bugs,
because you're too nomadic.
Well, no, I just came into finance through Bitcoin.
Okay.
Prior to discovering Bitcoin, I thought finance was boring, and I thought economics was boring, and all these things. I was so 100% wrong. I admit that now, but I never.
A lot of it is boring.
Well, yeah, but the part, as in Austrian economics,
yeah,
like human action, you know, things that you can look at an economic market and you can see how people, who people are, what they're doing, you know, how they express themselves, all that kind of stuff. That was the bit I knew nothing about. But as a result, I went straight into hard money at Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And listening to you speak about gold made me realize just how deeply ingrained it is in the human psyche. and how probably Bitcoiners who say gold's old and, you know, we're moving into the digital world now, gold's going to become worthless, or we can mine an asteroid or whatever, are probably wrong, I would say. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, the... when were you born, just out of interest?
71.
Okay, so you're...
that's what happened in 71.
So you're... Like, what I've found with the arguments between Bitcoiners and gold bugs is it's a lot of it is just generational. And people born, say, before maybe 1960, something like that, tend to be the pure gold bugs. And people born after about, say, 1980 tend to be much more pro-Bitcoin. And then there's this sort of 65 to 75 middle ground, people who'd be in their 50s today, who are like, well, I can see the merits of both. And obviously there is exceptions to that. It's just a sweeping generalization. But and I think a lot of the gold bugs resent it because Bitcoin did everything that gold and silver were supposed to do, you know, go to the moon. And it made so many Bitcoiners rich off the same arguments that they'd been saying using for gold and silver, which never quite happened for gold and silver, not back then anyway. But so there's a bit of resentment. And like everything on the internet these days, you've got to be team A or team B, and you know, which team are you? And there's no room for team nuance. But Bitcoin is fantastic. I don't need to start singing the praises of Bitcoin on here, and it's just one of the most wonderful inventions ever. And if you are unable to realize what a good invention it is, that's just your inability to recognize what a good invention it is. Doesn't mean it's not a good invention. And the proof of what a good invention it is the growth that it's seen from nothing to $1 trillion asset, and the amount of people that it's brought into its network. And again, if you don't get it, fine, you don't get it, but that's on you, not on Bitcoin. And it's just brilliant, and it's hard money. But it's, and then you go, well, you can't see it, you can't feel it. Well, no, of course you can't. It's digital, and that's why it's such good money. Because it's created digital hard money, and it's an incredible breakthrough in computer science to have done that. Whereas gold is hard money, and it's nature's money, and it's God's money, and but it's physical, and one is a physical asset, and one is a digital asset, and you can go, you can't just sit there and go, well, but because they're both money. In different senses of the word, but you know, gold is a brilliant unit of account, and I think it will always be a better unit of account than Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is a better medium of exchange. I was able to send a payment of one sat, which would be like a 20th of a cent or something, from me to Australia, to a guy in Australia, and then every day billions of dollars of value change hands, bosh, nobody's permission, and it costs a few pennies to make the transfer. It's a brilliant medium of exchange, and its use as a store of wealth. Well, it's gone from nothing to $60,000, so it's a pretty good store of wealth, but it's not such a good store of wealth if you're one of the people who bought it at $120,000. It might go back to $120,000. I hope it does. But gold is the less volatile of the two. But it comes back to the thing. One is physical and one is digital. And there are times when physical things are useful and matter and are important. And there are times when we ascribe to them very little value. You know, when you're chucking stuff out and you're going to the car boot stores, oh, I don't want the stuff, get rid of it. But, you know, it might be worth a lot of money to somebody else. And there are times when digital assets seem meaningless. And then there are times when digital assets are incredibly practical and valuable. But one is digital and one is physical. And they both have their strengths and weaknesses. And it's as simple as that. And there's a lot of crossover between the two, because they're both, as I say, stores of wealth and mediums of exchange to an extent. But they're different. and they both have their role, and I like them both, and I think there's room for both in every portfolio. And I tell all my readers, you know, I have a newsletter called The Flying Frisbee, to which I urge all your viewers to sign up to, but I just say own both and don't bother getting dragged into the which is better argument, because it's fruitless.
Do you, how much can you ascribe to Bitcoin in the sense that it will have us longevity like gold has?
It won't.
No. You don't think it won't.
No, because something will come along, I don't know when, in 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, there'll be some new technology that gets invented that's better than digital technology. But for the moment, digital technology is awesome, and it's the number one thing. And as long as it reigns supreme, then Bitcoin will reign supreme. But if somebody invents something better than digital, then Bitcoin's over.
I don't know what that can be, I suppose.
I haven't got a clue, but it exists. But gold is physical, and there will always be, you know, gold's been here. One of the things I say in the book is, you know, gold is older than the solar system. It's older than the sun. It's older than the earth. And it's been here all that time unchanged. And it'll be here long after human beings have blown up the planet and destroyed themselves.
What use would it have, though, in the say in the 22nd century? What use would it have? Because it does suffer
gold.
From... No, but it does, yeah, gold. It does suffer.
That's no use.
The store of value, say. Yeah. It suffers immensely from the ability to move it around, which is a big problem with gold. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the modern world does is it helps us move around more. Like, we have opportunities to move like never before. And probably once we go off planet, people probably aren't going to want to be transporting gold.
Well, again,
I don't know. Maybe they will.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, one of the best sections of my book is the... When the Nazis invaded, the very first thing they'd do to every country is they'd walk straight up to the central bank and confiscate the gold, like literally within an hour of invading the country. And so you had these kind of farcical wild goose chases with central banks trying to get their gold on trucks and drive it out of the city and onto the trains before the Germans got there. And you had, you know, the Polish gold went, I'm going to get this wrong now, but it went from something like Poland to Romania to Lebanon to... somewhere else to France and ended up in Martinique and Senegal. You know, talk about wild goose chase, and some of it ended up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So, you know, and that was the problem, trying to keep the Polish gold from the Nazis. And so that is both the strength of gold is like, you know, I've got gold, I've got the money, it's nobody else's liability. You nick it off me, you've got the gold, and I'm left with nothing. And there's no insurer to, well, there might be an insurer, but you know, there's no bank to make good the theft. So that is the problem with gold. And when I hear these arguments about, well, you know, we're going to start mining asteroids, you know, okay, there might be more gold per ton in an asteroid than there is on planet Earth. But at the moment, if you had 3 grams of gold per ton, even 2 grams of gold per ton, that is considered a mineable deposit. So you have to process a ton of rock to get 2 grams of gold. And that's a heck of a lot of rock that you have to get through to get your gold. And how are you going to do that in outer space? You know, have you been to a mine? Have you seen the equipment that there is in a mine? How are you going to get all those huge trucks and jeeps and processing plants and flotation tanks and all that? How are you going to get robots in outer space to do that? We're so many years from being in a position where we can do that. And then, you know, a ton of gold is like a suitcase full. Are you really going to be transporting thousands of tons of gold from outer space back to Earth? What kind of rockets are you going to be using? Everything about rockets is they've got to be as light as they possibly can, you know, in order, you know, as hard as they can, as light they can. I mean, I know it's outer space, but they'll sink.
Maybe they'll use outer space as the central banks. It's not well, a bad maybe. Idea because well, you could probably push the gold around really easily.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. So it's a bit like then we're into John Law territory. Is that plot of gold on that bit of asteroid is mine, and I'll sell it to you for £200 million, and it's yours for £200 million, and you can buy it off me. You know, I mean, fine. But there's just a lot of scope for fraud there, put it that way.
Well, yeah.
Plots of land on asteroids in outer space. And so, but even if there was somehow a way of mining asteroids and getting the gold back to the Earth and increasing the gold supply. This is what happened in 1850 when the gold in California was discovered, and then that led to the discovery of the gold in Australia, and that led to the discovery of gold in Canada, New Zealand, and of, most significantly of all, in South Africa. And it all happened over a 30-40 year period, and the gold supply just went up beyond all recognition. And The Economist wrote a famous thing, and French economist wrote an entire book why the gold price was going to crash, and The Economist magazine, the gold price is going to crash with all the increased gold. He was wrong. It didn't crash at all. All that happened is it got more widely adopted, and the big casualty of the increased supply of gold was silver, and that was when we stopped using silver as money, and the world went from bimetallic standards in 1850 to pure gold standards in 1900. So that if we did increase the supply of gold due to asteroid mining, it might be that the casualty is not gold. It might be that the increased supply of gold leads the world back onto a gold standard, because suddenly there's more gold to go round, and it makes the practicalities of a gold standard better. You couldn't have go back to a gold standard now without revaluing gold up like from $4,000 to $40,000 or something. You'd have to revalue up 10 times. And you couldn't do that unless you just said anyone who owns gold gets a huge tax on them or has to hand in their gold like they did in the 30s. You just couldn't do that upwards revaluation, because so many people get rich unjustly at the back of it, and government would want their share of the money. Well, the problem solver would be the increased supply of gold from asteroids. So it's just the whole thing is a stupid red herring argument from people who don't know what they're talking about.
Right. I've got another one that needs correcting then. Another thing I heard on the internet, you were talking about when you invade a country, the first thing you do is grab the gold.
Yeah.
Is it true that the gold after World War II was kind of given in the possession of the Americans to sort of look after? And of course, then they never gave it back. Is that kind of what happened?
No, that's not strictly true. So the Nazis stole a shed load, and the Japanese stole a shed load. I can't even, you know, thousands of tons. And everywhere the Nazis invaded, they took gold off the central banks, they took gold off the citizens, and sent it back to Berlin. And that was one of the reasons why it was a mistake to invade Russia, because the Russian citizens didn't have as much gold as, you know, the Dutch and the Belgians and the French. But anyway, they sent it back to Berlin. And then as Germany fell apart, the Nazis... there was literally a land grab, and they just grabbed some of it, got buried underground, but they were planning to bury it, hide it, and then use it to fund the Fourth Reich, but that never happened. But some of it got buried and found. The American forces found it, but a load of it just got nicked, and most of it, some of it got lost. There's about a million documentaries about hidden Nazi gold and all of that. And there's also some of it's below a lake called Lake Valkensee. Others is hidden in the Bavarian Alps. Some of it's hidden in a train line in Poland. There's all these different stories about where it ended up. But the reality is a lot of Nazis pocketed it and disappeared to South America. So a lot made its way. And you just need to look at Argentinian gold reserves at the beginning of the official gold reserves at the beginning of the war and at the end of it, and Brazilian. And you're like, whoa, how did that? They all like triple, quadruple their gold reserves at the national level. We don't know how much went in. And so, yeah, the gold was used to fund their things because it was the most portable form of wealth. But the gold that the Americans found, a lot of it, like they found a lot of Hungarian gold, and they just ran off. The Americans just nicked it. But that's not at the national level. The soldiers and the colonels and all of that, there were these Hungarian gold trains, and they just nicked what was on there. Not just gold, but wealth. But a lot of the stuff that they found in Thuringia, which is central Germany, and other gold hoards got sent to Frankfurt, and then eventually it was sent back to the nations that had had their gold stolen from them at the national level. The individuals who had their gold stolen from them never got their gold back. And obviously a lot of Jewish people that happened to, but a lot of just ordinary European citizens as well. They just never got the gold back because to reconstitute it at the personal level was just too big an undertaking. But so, for example, I'm not sure about Austria, but let's say Hungary, Belgium, for example, had its gold taken and they got a portion of that gold back at the end of the war, not all of it, but some of it. And it was given back to them at roughly, they each got like 60% or whatever the number is. So that's the German gold. But the reality is a lot of it went missing and nobody quite knows how much, hence all the conspiracy stuff. The big one is the Japanese gold, because they stole as much as the Nazis did. And they looted everywhere they conquered in Asia. They looted the gold. China, Myanmar, Malaysia, everywhere they went, they looted the gold. And, you know, they'd go into the monasteries and take the Buddhist statues and all the gold leaf and all the artwork, as well as the actual coinage. And they were shipping it back to Japan. And then America were torpedoing the ships. So they built a load of tunnels in the Philippines and they hid it in the Philippines. And then they blew the tunnels up. And they actually blew the tunnels up with the people inside them, because they didn't want anyone to know that the gold had been hidden there. So that was the slaves who had been digging the mines, the prisoners of war. You know, when I say slaves, you know, the Japanese made slaves of their captives, and so did the Germans. But yeah, the slaves they got to dig the mines, but also the Japanese officers themselves would be blown up in the mines. Terrible story. And some of that gold got found, and it's believed what funded Imelda Marcos's shoes, among other things. And but a lot of that gold, nobody knows what happened to it. And a lot of it is believed to have fallen into the hands of the US. And it then, what did the and the CIA, and there's a conspiracy theory about that. And, you know, maybe like a lot of conspiracy theories, it turns out to be true. But one of the reasons for the formation of the CIA itself had something to do with the Japanese gold. And America used it to prop up the dollar in the post-Bretton Woods era. Or a lot of it was used to fund American operations in the Far East during that post-war period in the fight against communism. That's another theory. But the ultimately is nobody quite knows. But I think that's where you might be getting it from. So it's the Japanese gold that's the big murky one.
I think also it's also to do with when the Nixon shock happened.
Yeah,
whose gold was that they weren't going to kind of give back at that point?
Well, what was happening there is, I mean, every country was doing it, but France was the kind of the ringleader, which was, it had dollars and it says, we don't want the dollars, we want the gold.
Right.
So hand his dollars in and give us your gold.
But it was never their gold per se.
Their dollars, and the dollar was exchangeable with
right.
gold.
Okay, right. And
Nixon, the point was Nixon had printed way more, well, not just Nixon, Truman, they were all at it. America, because apart from anything else, America printed a shedload of money like immediately after Bretton Woods to try and help boost the economies in the post-war era. So, I mean, it was all from about 1947, it was destined to go wrong. But they were just but Nixon called their bluff, basically, and he was redeeming. France actually sent two battleships to New York to collect the gold. Can you imagine sending two battleships to New York today?
And they went back empty-handed.
No, they got the gold. They got the gold, but they also ended up, they resulted in Nixon abandoning the gold standard.
Do we ever break free from, talking about gold, one of the problems with gold is paper gold, which is basically what all this is, let's say. And even when you back your currency with gold, so you go on a gold standard, obviously it's still really easy to renege on that. Mm-hmm. And do we ever escape from that? I mean, this is one of the beauties potentially of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Is that it's a bearer asset, but it's a digital bearer asset, mm-hmm. which is an amazing idea, because you can literally send that one sat that went to Australia was actually real money. And once you left your phone, that was it.
Yeah.
You've no control of it. So do we ever, and especially in the modern world where really, I don't know about you, but I think there are more bad actors now than there's ever been. People are giving up on just playing by the rules everywhere you look. How do we solve that one, or do we not?
Well, you're right. Bitcoin is a digital bearer asset. If I give you a gold coin, it is a bearer asset. If I give you some paper representing some gold that's stored somewhere, it is not a bearer asset. It's a promissory asset. Similarly, if I send you some digital money representing gold stored somewhere in a vault or representing a portion of a gold mine in an asteroid, it's not a bearer asset. And so that's the problem is any kind of gold standard, the 20th century gold standards were ordinary citizens were not handling gold. It had been made illegal for American citizens to own gold. And the British, even though Britain went back on the gold standard in 1925 and most of Europe soon followed, they actually withdrew gold from circulation. So, yes, we were on a gold standard, but ordinary citizens weren't handling gold. Until 1914, the gold sovereign, a gold coin, was the pound coin. So until 1914, gold was actually a part of the money system. So it wasn't it was a gold standard in that paper money was redeemable for gold, but gold itself played a role in the money because we handled gold and silver coins, but silver was more nominal whereas gold was in the money. After 1914, that was no longer the case. So when people talk about gold standards, it's a sort of catch-all term that involves some clarification, because are you talking a gold standard like America was on in 1935 when Americans could own gold? Is that a gold standard? Or a gold standard like Britain was on in 1930 when there was no gold in circulation? Or are you talking about when gold was actually money? And so, because they're completely different. And in fact, what happened in, I want to say 1794, William Pitt was Prime Minister of the UK, and we were very worried about French revolutionary fervour spreading to the UK. And William Pitt was determined not to allow it to happen. And so he spent a great deal of money funding Napoleon's enemies on the continent. And he would send them gold, money, to use to fund whatever their activities, their being opponents to Napoleon. And because of the guineas that he sent had a picture of St. George, as in St. George and the dragon on them, this was known as the Golden Cavalry of St. George. And he ran out, the UK ran out of gold because he'd sent so much abroad. And the Bank of England actually came to Pitt and said, you need to stop redeeming paper. People can't redeem paper with us because we have not got the gold to redeem the paper against. You need to stop gold being interchangeable. So Pitt said yes and took Britain off the gold standard in the mid 1790s. And with the immediate consequences, we had prices doubled. We had runaway inflation. They always go up in war anyway because of war. But prices doubled. We had inflation, and then there was the riots, and there was all sorts of problems at home. And we didn't go back onto the gold standard. We had a great recoinage in 1816, but formally we didn't readopt the gold standard until 1821. So we spent 25 years off the gold standard, give or take. And, you know, that's half a lifetime for a lot of people back then. So it's not an insignificant period of time. And so I guess there were still gold coins in circulation, but paper money was not redeemable for gold until we went back onto the gold standard. And there was the remonetization, the recoinage, the invention of the sovereign, all sorts of developments. And but that sort of became the bedrock of British commerce after 1821 and the return to the gold standard. So, you know, even when gold was money, the gold standard still failed. And even, you know, Britain was powerful then. It got more powerful in the 19th century and then, you know, whatever. But so gold standards fail, even reasonably good ones, because of politicians.
Maybe then the Bitcoin Gold Alliance could solve that. I mean, it does solve that in a way, with the physical bearer asset being backing something and the digital bearer asset being the one that gets transmitted over long distances.
Well, yeah. I mean, Bitcoin and gold between them, sound money solves so many problems, biggest among them being the government overreach and big government and all the nefarious consequences of that. And yes, sound money solves them. And, you know, fix money, fix the world. I've been a believer in that motto since, I don't even know who coined that. I coined a lot of phrases, but I didn't coin that one. But, you know, I've been a big believer in that for a long time. The logic underpins, I wrote a film called Four Horsemen that was hugely popular, and a book called Life After the State and Bitcoin, the Future of the World. And now this book, The Secret History of Gold. You know, sound money, fix money, fix the world is the central thesis behind all of them. And I profoundly believe in that. But don't expect politicians to do it for you, because they won't. I think there's like maybe out of 650 politicians in the Bank of England, in the UK Parliament, there's maybe one or two that might understand sound money, if that. And, you know, there's a few more in America, I'm pleased to say, but there's still a paucity and nobody on the left gets it. And so we're so far from this being a fix made by politicians. The fix has to be individuals acting in their own. I mean, central bank buying will go a long way to doing that, but that's central bank buying. That's not, you know, policy from politicians, but individuals acting in their own self-interest, wanting to hold good money and get rid of the shit money and interacting with each other. And do you know what? I want to pay you a 20th of a cent. Well, I'm going to send you a sat. You know, the more the Bitcoin price goes up, the more that will happen. The more the Bitcoin price falls, the less that will happen. So we need the Bitcoin price to go up if we're to increase adoption, and people come originally for the gains and then they stay for the revolution. But the more people that do that, and the more people that start saving and spending in non-government currencies, the better the chance there is of a sound money returning. But the return will be by the back door. And a very realistic possibility is that you see governments get themselves into increasing amounts of problems. Governments go bankrupt. Their currencies do collapse, despite what I said at the beginning of the program. They do actually collapse. And they then blame the Bitcoiners and the gold bugs. It is their fault. You can rest assured. No, we saw this coming and we put our money. No. It's your fault. And we're going to confiscate. That is a very real possibility in the event of a proper currency collapse. Yeah. I'm not saying that will happen. I'm just saying it's a possibility.
If a 6102 occurred in the contemporary world, would it kind of have to occur everywhere all at once? No.
Well, the thing is in America, I think it would take the form of a. I don't know. One likely possibility is it would take the form of an unrealized capital gains tax.
I was just going to say that.
And the US government, problem, we're revaluing gold from $4,000 to $40,000 a gold, a thing. And then you then have to pay an unrealized capital gains tax of whatever percent. And everyone will get their knickers in a twist about it, and then because it's the government, they'll get away with it. It's harder to do that in America. But if you're in the UK and you saw signs of that coming, the obvious thing to do would be to leave. And UK has a massive millionaire exodus already. I think 15,000 millionaires left the UK last year or something ridiculous. And the reason they all left is higher taxes and better opportunities elsewhere. And who can blame them? You know, they changed the non-dom laws. They wanted to bring a load of taxes on non-doms, and the non-doms left. Makes sense. You know, the great Cooperthwaite quote was, money comes here because it knows it can leave if it wants to. And now the UK hasn't quite reached capital controls or exit taxes, but the UK is an easy country to leave if you want to. You just have to leave. And as long as you spend fewer than 90 days within a given year, you just fill in a form and you're no longer a UK taxpayer. But America, you can't do that. You are an American citizen for life wherever you are in the world, unless you renounce your citizenship. And only if you renounce your citizenship can you avoid paying US taxes. So the implications of Britain doing it to America doing it, if Britain were to do it, it would probably have to introduce an exit tax of some kind, or have a similar thing to America, whereas you're a British taxpayer wherever you are in the world.
I don't want to end on a bad note, a negative note. Let's think. What is the positive take on this? Let's forget government for a moment, because they're not incentivized to ever want a hard money standard, because it takes away their ability to print money. We know that. So what is the white pill on all this money stuff? What's the thing that we can look at and go, oh yeah, that's a pretty good timeline. There's quite a high chance of that happening if we go forward into the future. What is it? What's the white pill?
White pill meaning the good thing that gets us out.
The opposite of the black pill.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's not a racist thing. Don't worry.
We're all
far right now.
The more people that use non-government currency, the better the chances of non-government currency becoming the norm are, and which is Bitcoin and gold. So I advocate their use. For practical reasons, because you're immunizing yourself from government debasement. And I advocate their use for moral reasons, because you're not enabling the fiat system to the same extent. But if you think that confiscation and all that is coming, then you need to look at where your citizenship is, what your location is, what your exit strategies, all of those things. If you, like me, you're a bit more disorganized and you think we're still quite a few years from that, then you can be a bit more, whatever the word is, lackadaisical about it. Blasé. But I remember these things happen very quickly when they do happen. Like 2008, I distinctly remember being a frozen rabbit in 2008. And, you know, I hosted a podcast back then, and we used to talk about the global margin call that's coming. And that's exactly what 2008 was. It was a guy who writes for my newsletter called John Wollstonecroft, who coined the phrase, the global margin call. And that's what 2008 was. And it happened very quickly. And so, I mean, you know, I did some things that looked nuts. I remember going with my wife at the time. We went to the cash and carry, and we bought like tins, rice. You know, like we had the garage was just full of emergency supplies, because we thought, you know, everything was going to break down. And then we had a huge mice problem because they. And you know, we laugh at it now and we look stupid, but you know, we were trying to take sensible measures, and. Again, during COVID, we were days, you know, we ran out of loo paper briefly. You know, the supply chains, they're very, you know, they're vulnerable when they break down. And so these things can happen very quickly. And, you know, we're speaking at Liverpoolco, and there's a lot of hardcore libertarian, you know, anarcho-capitalist people who really have zero faith in their government here. And I sometimes listen to what they say and I think, oh, come on, you know, you're going too far here. And then I sometimes listen to what they say and I have a great deal of sympathy with their worldview. But, you know, these guys really have got their tinfoil hats and their house up in the hills. And I don't. But I guess the, you know, fortune favours the prepared. And just because you prepared for it and it never happened doesn't mean that preparation was wasted. And so maybe you should have your tinfoil hat and your little hideout ready. And I mean, you know, if it's a choice between living in a socialist, UK socialist state, I mean, proper like Eastern Europe pre-1990 socialist state for 20 years, or going to live in another country and coming back when it all unravels, or perhaps my kids coming back, then I think I would rather go and live in another country and come back in 20 years time rather than just have to live through 25 years of socialism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. I 100% agree. I think that's one of the best moves of the next 25 years, potentially, is some kind of geo arbitrage. Mm. I mean, it's worth it.
Geo arbitrage.
That's a conversation we have at the kitchen table now. And my wife's got loves the UK and loves deeply.
You live in the UK.
Yeah. But we talk about that now when the kids get to a certain age, probably, because I think you mentioned the wealth taxes, the kind of a cap gains taxes.
Yeah.
They're almost certainly coming simply because they're being talked about now. And when things get talked about publicly, so they normally happen. So whatever, and they're a really, that's a really insipid tax because, like you say, you basically have to start selling your assets to start paying the bill.
I mean, it's awful.
Yeah.
It's just wrong on so many different
levels. Exactly. Well, that's for me, not least ideologically, that's a line in the sand. Probably, literally, it's a line in the sand. Because if we have to pay...
They'll be talking about it. The only reason, you know, but you can be sure that Burnham and the rest of them, they are talking about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're socialists, so they don't have the same respect for private property that right-wingers do. But they will be talking about it. And the reason they won't be imposing it will not be the moral reasons. It'll be the practical difficulties of imposing it. Mm. And it is, they are quite difficult to impose. And the, you know, they've got to look at the cost benefit and all that and how many votes they lose and blah, blah, blah. But you know, they're talking about it.
Yes, they are. But I think, you know, one of the, like I say, the next step for the government is putting up walls to stop you leaving, which they're doing already with the taxes. Mm-hmm. There'll be physical blocks to you leaving at some point. If you know, that's what happens if you follow the timeline forward enough.
They put walls up though. The dinghies won't be able to get in. How's that going to work?
Well, what happened in Berlin when the walls went up?
Yeah.
Everyone wanted to come the other way, right? They didn't want to go into East Berlin, did they? Well, very few people. I think the dinghies will be going back. I think the dinghies will be going out. We'll be looking for dinghies on the other side. Yeah. But anyway, look.
That could be quite a funny meme. It's just loads of English people on dinghies going out to Calais. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a good... Yep, put it in your next set, mate. By the way, before we go, I'd never heard you live before. I listened to you live the other night. Very funny.
Oh, thank you.
I sent a video. I mean, it's pretty full on as well. It's. I sent your classic "fuck the government" video to my friend. I said I'm at a rock concert right now, and sent it. And I sent it before the main, what's it called, the chorus came.
Oh yeah.
So you've got all the dun, 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 and it's "fuck the government." Yeah. He laughed anyway. Yeah, shame we can't talk a bit longer. I really enjoy this. But Dominic, thanks. Really
my
appreciate
pleasure.
It. Appreciate it.
Can I just, if I can, just plug
of course.
My website. My newsletter is theflyingfrisbee.com. Yes. And my latest book is The Secret History of Gold, published by Penguin, available at all good bookshops. And by all accounts, the best book on gold ever written.
Right. You heard it here, right from the horse's mouth. It is the best book.
It's not for me to say, but I'll tell you who said that. Adam Fleming, who's Ian Fleming's nephew and, you know, gold bug of many, you know, he's read everything. He says, he sent me an email saying, I've read every book ever written on the precious and yours was the best by far.
And if you do buy it, look out for the anecdote about the Wizard of Oz, which I heard years ago and I'd forgotten about. That's really, I'm not even going to tell you what it is now, so you can go and read the book.
That went down very well in the talk today.
Yeah.
That bit.
Yeah, it did. But it is, people think the Wizard of Oz is connected with mind control and stuff, though, don't they? So,
oh, do they?
Don't you know that?
I didn't know.
They use Dorothy, you know, like going to the. They use it in the mind control programming things and stuff.
Oh, do they?
Okay. Oh, yeah. There's a whole rabbit hole there. Anyway, like, gotta go. Thanks, Dominic. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Right, you made it to the end of the show, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that you got some value out of this episode. If you want to help the show, please follow or subscribe right now. It takes only 2 seconds and it massively helps. If you've got another 30 seconds, well, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Honest reviews apparently are the single best way to help new listeners find us. If you want more, you can get bonus episodes and early access to episodes on fountain.fm for the price of one coffee for a whole month. Or you can support the mission by streaming sats on any of the value for value platforms, or use the Bitcoin and fiat donation links in the show notes. Every contribution to the show makes a real difference. believe me. And one more thing, if you know someone who'd love this episode, share it directly with them. That personal share beats every algorithm in the book. All the links, the community, and the newsletter are in the show notes. And jump on over to freecities.fm for a deep dive into all the episodes with descriptions and more. That's the new Free Cities podcast website, freecities.fm. Have a good week and see you next time.